The Fancy Film Fellows employs a frank discussion of cinema that includes adult language and descriptions of mature situations. We have no concern for spoilers, so be warned, you might learn more than you'd care to know. Heralds and announcements.
Hey everyone, it's another podcast, another Fancy Film Fellows podcast coming at you. Our very first Heralds and announcements, aka our favorite and least favorite films that we've seen in any recent time. It's a format that may be familiar to some of you who knew our old podcast. But this time we're doing it in a full feature length style. So we basically
no more shorts. We want to apply for the big awards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everything we used to do is like a thing before we discussed the movie in full length. Now we're gonna do for the entirety of the podcast by popular demand. That popular demand being by our demand.
And we're extremely popular.
Yeah, so it's the usual. It's the usual crew today. It's me, Ilya. Hello, everyone. We have Basil also joining us.
Hey
Basil. And we have Ruben and Patrick joining us together. So
this is the thing the kids
saw, dude.
Patrick's doing the finger thing. So we're gonna just do this thing round robin style, just going around the horn and having people say their herald or denouncement. So we're gonna start with Ruben.
So you want to do the? Let's do the.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there's the theme.
Can't lose that.
Can't lose the theme.
Gotta have the mouth sounds.
Yes.
So I decided today that I'm just gonna go with sort of one of each category. So herald and denounce a rewatch, and herald and denounce a new to me. And I'll start off with the freshest one, which is I watched True Lies last week. And I'm going to say, denounce! I denounce True Lies.
Boom.
Send it to the guillotine.
It's canceled. Get it out of here.
Yeah, it definitely is canceled. Because, like, basically the big problem with it is that Arnold Schwarzenegger is, like, an extremely jealous psychopath. And he's, like, our hero, and we're supposed to, like, I don't know, identify with him as he gaslights and tortures his wife for, like, the first half of the movie. It's pretty upsetting to watch, and it's, like, I think the film itself even recognizes that, like, it doesn't know where to go with the tone a lot of the time, like, because it has, like, very broad, obvious slapstick qualities. Like, there's at least four people getting kicked in the nuts in the movie. And, you know, the classic, like, Arnold-style one-liners. Like, everyone, like, you know, like, you're fired or whatever. But then, like, it also tries to be, like, darkly serious at other times. And, yeah, like... It was, at times, considered, like, so bad, in my opinion, that I considered thinking it was, like, the worst movie I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a couple of things that are good enough about it that pulled it back from that. Like, people are right, the iconic moment of them kissing in front of a nuclear blast is pretty surreal to watch. And very 90s.
I don't remember that part.
Yeah, I've forgotten that one, too.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one since I was like a teenager or something.
Oh. Lots of evil Arab terrorists in that one.
Yeah. Sure, and it's real bad.
Yeah.
They're both like extremely incompetent and like completely evil. And they give like a speech about how the reason that they're doing this is because they want the U.S. to pull out of the Middle East in general. They're non-specific origin Middle Easterners. And they talk about like killing the women and children, but like no one like even like pauses to like think about the validity of that. Mm-hmm. They're just like, they got nukes.
All
right.
There's a bunch of stuff that doesn't make sense too, but whatever. I don't really care about plot nonsense that much.
Yeah, screw that movie.
I'd like it more if they remade it from Jamie Lee Curtis's perspective as a horror movie.
Yeah. Finding out her husband's been lying to her their entire marriage and
that he's a murderer.
Yeah.
All right. Patrick, what do you think?
All right. Well, I throughout February watched 2 4-star movies, so I'm going to try and talk about both of them.
Right now?
One, yeah, no, not in this segment. But
at the same time.
Yes.
Gotcha.
He's going to cut his audio from one and overlay it over the other.
No, but the movies, or the first one that I watched that I really liked was called The 11th Year. It's a documentary by Ziga Vertov from, I think, 1928. Yeah, 1928. You know, it's, I don't know if you'd call it typical Soviet propaganda, but it's, you know, definitely a Soviet propaganda film. But I, you know, find its imagery very, like, affecting, and I really enjoy the way that he juxtaposes images of things like these old bones of these Scythian soldiers that they dig up with all of the sort of like industrial advancement and these factories and people going into factories and mines and, you know, people working these fields at co-ops. And it's just all these like really interesting juxtapositions. And there's a lot of water imagery too, because the whole film sort of revolves around building of this power station along this river. And so it's them sort of like blasting these old sort of like natural formations away to make this new power station that was like in the film. It says it'll be the largest one in Europe. I don't know if it still is, but it was a, you know, like a really big deal to them to build this very modern sort of industrial thing in that area.
Is it the canal?
I don't know if it's a, I don't think it's a canal. It's like a big,
I was thinking of something else.
Yeah, no, but it's, I mean, it's a, you know, Ziga Vertov is very good at using imagery. I've seen a couple of his other films now. There's a huge archive of old Soviet movies on YouTube on a channel called All Soviet Movies from Our Vision, I believe is what it's called. But it's just a treasure trove of, you know, just like cool stuff that I had never known was available.
And cool.
It's very cool to see, and Ziga Vertov's very good. I actually like Ziga Vertov more than Eisenstein at this point.
In your face, Sergei.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Maybe I'll see another Eisenstein movie that will bring him back up in my estimation, but having watched multiple of their films now, I'm definitely on the Ziga Vertov side.
You gotta choose sides. You can like everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite part about Eisenstein is that they, for a long time, people used still photos from the movie October to depict the actual October Revolution, which is really funny.
Yes, yeah, and I watched that movie.
They got it so right, they literally replaced history.
Yeah, no, there was a documentary, I think I talked about it, the documentary that I watched 2 years ago, I think, that was about the Russian Revolution, and they literally used the storming of the Winter Palace from October.
Yeah, as, like, that's really cool.
Archival footage.
Yeah. Very funny.
It was very funny.
Yeah, in your face, Peter Jackson. They were creating fake redoing footage way back then.
Yep.
Yeah, nice. On to Basil.
Technique shall not grow old.
I'll go ahead and denounce Final Destination.
The series?
No.
Movie.
Just the first one.
Okay.
I mean, I guess I could have said Final Destination 1, but that's not technically the movie's title.
No, it's
but,
not.
I hadn't seen it, I think, since the theater, but I was a big fan when I saw it in the theater, and it was, some of its, it's technically a 2000s movie, but it has a lot of, like, you know, the late 90s horror stylization that hasn't aged particularly well. It's very corny now. It's very silly, and the movie at times seems intentionally silly, like tongue-in-cheek and stuff, but then other times, like, the violence is very, very brutal and very graphic in a way that was like, this is unsettling. This is at odds with the jokiness of some of the other parts of it. And it never really finds a good balance with that. And there's a lot of, the swaying camera of, like, they do it a lot in, I remember Harry Potter right around this time as well, where it's like something weird is happening, so the camera will be like tilting as it's moving towards someone, and it's like tilting almost all the way to the side, and it's like, ooh, with spooky music, and I was just like, this movie isn't really scary, but it's also like not really like a dark comedy, it's just kind of an awkward middle space that it occupies, and, yeah, I think, I haven't rewatched much of it, but when I tried to go back and rewatch The X-Files, that was basically how I felt about the show, too. I was like, ooh, this show is, like, pretty corny, pretty bad, so it makes sense that James Wong got his start there, and then used that X-Files clout to make this movie that spawned a pretty big franchise. It's been dormant for a while. I wonder if they're ever going to make another one.
Who knows? They can find some more Rube Goldberg ways to kill people.
Yeah. You never run out of those.
Nope.
But, I think that was one of the things that I really liked about it. Initially was like, oh, wow, you know, it is unnerving to think about how many ways I could just easily die in my day-to-day life. Like, just being in my bathroom, I could die. It happens to people. Obviously not regularly, but it is a little astonishing that it doesn't happen more regularly, considering how many deadly things are surrounding us at all times.
Really makes you think.
That I always say that, like, any camera technique, you know, or any aesthetic choice can be used well in the right circumstance, but maybe that camera technique is the one exception. The dolly-in twist. Like, I can't imagine a way to use that. That
and be like, whoa.
Would make me like the movie more for having used it. Like, even ironically, it's kind of like, yeah, it's an easy joke.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, moving on to me and my, I'm going to herald My Best Friend's Wedding, a movie that I think has already been mentioned on this podcast before in a positive way. It's a really, really strange movie. Has an incredible disparity between, like, the main female character who quite like, not unlike what Ruben talked about in True Lies, is also kind of a sociopath person who wants to destroy this other person's life just because she's into that guy. And like how boring that guy is. like it's really it's kind of funny that like the movie tried to almost purposely make him just incredibly just dull and like and unspecial in almost every way.
Yeah, it's shocking that both and a little bit implausible that Julia Roberts
and Cameron Diaz
would be
so into
going this hard for this doofy guy.
Yeah, which I guess at some point...
Unintentional commentary.
Yes, it kind of becomes just a battle of wills between them. There's a lot of really good singing scenes in this movie. They kind of... it's like to such a degree that it almost reminded me of like how a lot of Soviet movies would just have singing just in the middle of them, especially romantic comedies from like the 70s and 80s would just have the main characters at some point start singing with no real reason why. And just as much here, like all the singing scenes are extended really, really long. And I really like the weird artificiality of that and like how much people lean into those songs. It's really good. The performances are really, really good, especially Julia Roberts is incredibly good at facial acting in this movie. And she's often seen just reacting to stuff happening and has like a lot of subtle like movements of the eyes and like how she kind of tries to hide her like jealousy and like to not show disgust at how much everyone's fawning over Cameron Diaz and like all these things. It's really good. It's really fun. And I watched it while getting drunk and texting with my brother who was at his place while I was at mine. And it's a great way to watch a movie if you're alone.
Mm-hmm. Just good times. Synchronized.
Yep. Big thumbs up.
Yeah, that movie rules.
I will say this in the male character's favor. Dermot Mulroney is hot.
True. Yeah, he's a total... yeah. He's basically eye candy. That's what he is.
Yeah. Yeah, the Entertainment Weekly did the 20th anniversary or whatever recently, and they, on the cover, I was like, whoa, he's still looking good. Maybe even better. He has like... silver hair. I'm like, he's a regular silver fox. Ooh. Great.
Yeah, nice. I think it worse. Like, his attractiveness has plateaued. Like, he isn't any less hot than he was in 1998 or whatever.
He started out pretty hot.
And everybody else is, like, gone down a peg, at least.
Yep.
Hot dude.
Mm. Ruben, what's your next Herald or an announcement?
I'll do my first Herald and my first new-to-me movie discussed, and that's the 1939 The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Mm.
I Herald it.
Mm.
A lot of what's good about this movie is covered in a lot of detail in Lindsay Ellis's video about the Hunchback of Notre Dame series. It's an explicitly anti-fascist movie made in 1939 in America that draws a direct line between people's treatment of immigrants and their treatment of humanity in general, like their capability for morality. And it's kind of centered on a very unnerving performance from Charles Laughton that's certainly not the hunchback of popular culture, although probably somewhere in between that and the original Hunchback as written by what's his name?
Victor Hugo.
He's kind of like pitiable and like you have empathy for him, but he also seems like very explicitly non-human in a way. Like he exists in a liminal space between like how much we are supposed to care for humans and like say how much we are supposed to care for animals. Like the film also has a goat character, and it's unclear whether or not people care more for the goat or for the hunchback.
Thanks.
In a way that's I guess revealing also another like way of like sort of unintentionally maybe even commenting on fascism's obsession with binaries, and like, you know, they don't see the hunchback as either like a slightly worse human or a slightly better animal. Like, he's worse than both because he's not either.
Yikes.
And I think Lawton leans into it in a really uncomfortable way that will make you, if you watch it as an audience member, like, hard to like root for him,
right?
And whatever his goals are, which I guess it's mostly just being obsessed with Esmeralda.
Yeah.
But it's also super well shot, and just, yeah, it's a interesting movie.
Yeah, the able-bodied fetishization of fascism also probably plays into that pretty nicely.
Yeah, for sure. It's a movie with some pretty explicit commentary, I guess, on ableism.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I could say that as well.
Yeah.
Nice.
Patrick?
I don't even know if I knew that it existed.
Yeah. I don't think we would have known it existed if it hadn't been for that Lindsay Ellis video going through the the Hunchback of Notre Dame as a like character in the sort of like media canon. But yeah, she's got some good videos.
It's the same director as Portrait of Ginny, which was like a popular obscure film in Art of Vision that I thought was okay, but it definitely made me want to revisit that and see how I felt about it now as a fully grown adult.
Yeah. Well, the next movie that I'm going to herald is called Haxan, Witchcraft Through the Ages. It's from 1922. And this film is actually like surprisingly on point about the ways in which women have been sort of marginalized throughout history in very specific ways, mostly revolving around people accusing them of being witches and people blaming sort of like psychological problems on witchcraft, things like that. It also has a lot to say about actual like, you know, diagnoses of psychological issues in people and the way that, you know, to the modern lens, like all of the crazy things people did seem really outdated. And I think that's pretty like progressive for 1922 to be going back and being like, oh yeah, there were all these incidences of what we would now call like, you know, hysteria, which I know to the modern lens would probably be something like schizophrenia, but back then they were just like, it has to be witches or whatever, and they're like, just, you know, like psychological problems don't exist. And so it's very critical of all of that too. It goes back and it's like, man, this was really horrible that we did all these things, and almost all of it to women, most especially older women who, you know, had not been married, who lived alone, and, you know, who were kind of each other's support system. People always accuse them of being witches because they didn't fit into the, you know, sort of like societally stamped mold of, you know, a wife or a mother or whatever. It's pretty good at that, actually. And I think that there's some really cool imagery in it too. In particular, the actor that plays the devil in it is doing a really fun, like, kind of weird face acting where he's just like rolling his eyes and sticking his tongue out a lot, and that's very fun and fun to look at. Yeah, I was surprised by how much I actually enjoyed this movie.
Nice. Yeah, it's on my list. I've heard basically nothing but good things, but haven't watched it yet.
Yep. Cool. Basil, what about you?
Go ahead and denounce a movie by James Wan instead of James Wong. Just keep the similar name train going on. But finally caught up with Aquaman and didn't like it too much. I feel like he doesn't quite nail. I don't know if this idea could have ever worked, but it's very strange. The movie's pretty dumb, and all the actors are pretty committed to it, where it's just like a ton of exposition written like pretty clunkily, but like, you know, where it's just someone explaining to someone else, here's the sea and deep and here's all our lore and blah blah blah, and everyone's just constantly explaining it to each other, and they all do it pretty straight-faced. But then Jason Momoa gives a performance where it seems like he knows that he's just like in a dumb action movie and is like goofing around with it, and it seems very out of place with the rest of the movie, and I'm like, maybe there is a way this could work, but it doesn't, you know, quite work. I guess if the idea is to elevate Jason Momoa as like the only charismatic person in the movie, then it definitely works, because everyone else is like just a cardboard cutout of a performance. It's very boring, but I don't know. It's like all the... I mean, James Wan's a better action director than a lot of people, but it's still like... Wait, it's just a bunch of CGI. It's a big mess down underwater. Even when it looks cool, I'm still just like, yeah, but why? And then when everybody's fighting, it feels like it's really pretty threadbare in terms of motivation, where it's like, narratively, you could just cut this whole fight scene out, have something else. Like, there's a pretty long action sequence where it ends with Aquaman being, like, subdued and taken in. And I was like, you could have just cut to him, you know, because he just gets shocked or something like that. And I was like, you could have just started with getting shocked and got rid of this whole scene. It wasn't that interesting. And a lot of them are like that. I'm just like, man, this is going on too long. And there's too many of them. There's two villains. Sick of these two villain superhero movies. You cut out the entire other villain, get rid of him forever, and or save him for Aquaman 2, and wouldn't have noticed. It didn't make any difference. He's not contributing to the overall plot very much. But yeah, a disappointment, since I'm something of a... I don't know if I'm a James Wan fan, but I've liked an okay amount of his movies. About 50-50.
Mm.
Until this. Tipping it to the other side. Oh no. Aquaman, what are you doing?
I just need to know if they finally gave him permission to come aboard. Because that's the only question that I want the movie to answer.
No. They sure don't. But he takes permission by force.
Oh, no.
That's fairly strongly hinted at in the trailer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's like throwing covers at them and stuff.
Yep, he sure is.
Sword for some reason. Someone has a sword in a submarine. Why? Just because.
Yeah. So he can get stabbed and it not hurt him, so you can tell he's got super strength or super skin or something like that. But then, you know. And then they can do it later where he gets stabbed by an Atlantean steel weapon, and then it does cut him, so he's not impervious. Uh-oh.
Mm.
This underwater steel can really hurt him. How do they forge steel underwater, by the way?
It's a good question.
Some of those underground volcanoes, seawater volcanoes, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Does he have a sword or a trident? Because this would definitely be an opportunity for someone to have a trident.
He does have a trident, but other people have swords. And then he gets a better trident. Spoiler for that.
No.
You know, it's set up very early, this long-lost trident of Atlantis. No, it's a myth. You're making up stories. Or are you? Of course not.
Yeah. We live in a world in which we know that Atlantis exists, and I'm a half merman, but I don't believe a story about
what?
A fancy
trident. Get out of here.
Oh my god.
Well, since we're talking about dumb plot machinations, I'll just mention the thing about True Lies, which is sure. That they sneak the nukes into the country in like these old Persian like horse statues. Yeah, these like giant rock Persian, and there's like they're priceless, a pity. And then they like smash them to pieces to get the nukes out. And I'm like, how do they get the nukes in there?
Yeah.
How did they get them in there to ship it? And if, like, wouldn't it be obvious that they had been broken apart and then put back together if they didn't just like build new fake ones around it? Mm. And what was the whole point of the art dealer being a part of this if they were just going to build new fake ones?
Yeah. That's funny. Also, a very obvious Trojan horse reference.
Yeah. Americans love Persian art too much and almost cost them their lives.
So, all right, my next herald is a movie I didn't necessarily expect a herald when I rewatched it, and I liked it. A lot, kind of a lot, and it's Wolf of Wall Street, which is a weird movie to like, because now spending a lot of my time on LinkedIn, or having spent a lot of my time on LinkedIn as a recruiter, and seeing almost every second guy on LinkedIn posting the Leo memes 100% seriously, like how to like... Yeah. Be better at sales, how to like get, you know, how to get rich, how to sell a pen, like all that stuff. Like people out there like on LinkedIn being like, cold calling can be fun, just watch Leo do it, it's great. Like, there's not a hint, not a sense of irony that is ever apparent in that world. And that is definitely a scary proposition. And yet, the movie itself is really, really fun. It's almost, I mean, it's like 3 hours long. It's incredibly well-paced. Like, you barely feel... Like, a lot of Scorsese's movies drag. Like, especially now watching, like, Goodfellas or Casino. There's just parts that really, really sag. And where just not much happens. Or there's, like, really indulgent scenes, but, like, indulgent in, like, a really... in retrospect, kind of unfortunate way. Like, Joe Pesci... acting or like scenes that just don't really, you know, work that much anymore, like tragedy, especially like tragic scenes happening to characters you barely care about. Wolf of Wall Street kind of skips all over that and just basically gives you mostly all the excess stuff, and it's a lot, and it's like it's shot nicely, it's really, really funny. The script is by Soprano scribe Terrence Winter, and he's pretty good at writing these pretty awful people in really awful situations, being awful to each other. You know, it's really difficult to, like, I totally understand why people wouldn't like this movie, why people don't want to watch all these gross assholes who've ruined so many people's lives, like, you know, just indulge in all the stuff that people always get promised they might, if they just like play their cards right, and if they just work really hard, they might also get rich. Well, no, they won't, because they'll probably get scammed along the way by people like this. The one thing is that like the violence of this movie is really really sickening. Like the scenes where Leo punches his wife are incredibly like off-putting, when in like probably like the best way possible. Like the people that were like fanboying along with this guy until then definitely feel like definitely have to kind of question their allegiance maybe at that point. But you know, like
I wish
I doubt probably not. Leo, by the way, is amazing in this. Probably my favorite Leo DiCaprio performance. He's like it's a really wound up to 11 kind of performance, both physically and like from how funny he pronounces like all these incredibly weird sales scripts, really leans into the role. I mean, there's an unfortunate element of this being like such a good performance that people really get too into this character, but you know, like that's It's a difficult thing to fault a movie for, in my opinion. Yeah. But also, again, like, I totally get why people would hate it. So, you know, I enjoyed it. A lot of drugs in this movie, too.
It's also kind of Scorsese's history, in a way.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's why I don't like Raging Bull more. I like Wolf of Wall Street more than Raging Bull. But it's a similar thing where it's, like, it's so invested in being from the perspective of a horrible person that it's not really about commentary. It's sort of, it's more about exploring why they're so bad, and so people are like, it needs commentary, and it's like,
yeah, there's definitely like this head.
Maybe the audience needs a moral compass so that they know how to react to this type of stuff.
I mean, there's definitely the element of this, like, oh, we're just making fun, like, we're like, you know, we're just like showing it, and like, you can't fault us for showing it. Like, there's maybe like, there's a little cute from them to pretend like they're not into this, like. Clearly, the people making this movie are having a lot of fun playing these really ridiculous people. Like, there's not, like, a thing where they're like, oh, can you believe these absolute assholes? Like, these awful, awful humans. Like, the movie is not necessarily judging them at all while they're doing this. But it would also be fucking weird if it was. I don't think it would work at all if it was. So.
Trying to take the moral high ground.
Yeah. Might be called too obvious.
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. Like, he does seem to do that a lot in his movies, especially like Taxi Driver and Goodfellas, which people are like, we like these guys. These characters are cool.
I've never like, gotten how people could watch Taxi Driver and be like, I like this guy.
Like, it's really
he's the most awkward,
honestly.
At least like Leo's like, you know, good looking and like has like lots of fun in his life for most of this movie. He gets like really rich and gets to take lots of drugs. And, like, Travis Bickle's life is just miserable from start to finish. Like, the fact that people are just like, I want to be that guy is ridiculous to me.
But I mean, like, you know, you look at any person who's really into the Second Amendment and they're like, yeah, that's a cool character. He's got all those guns. He buys all those guns from that guy. He has all the cool ways to deploy guns to kill people. Mm-hmm. It's like,
sure,
oh,
does.
Lord.
All right. So, Ruben, what about your next pick?
I'm going to denounce The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, no.
The Disney movie from the 90s.
Nice.
I watched the back-to-back, and one is a lot worse than the other one. In my opinion. My complaint is the complaint I think that pretty much everyone has about this movie, which is that it has a lot of tonal problems. But I think most people just sort of focus on the really bad joking sidekicks and the like slightly more serious than normal Disney narrative, and sort of call it a day as to why the film didn't work for them. But on some level, that actually exists in pretty much every film, because, like, almost all of the time they're drawing from like a darker story than they actually display, and then adding in like some dumb comedy for kids.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it kind of exists in the space between what Disney, I guess what a lot of people call Golden Age Disney was, and the space that it would become, where Disney is kind of like now. For instance, with The Little Mermaid, you didn't have like any like truly famous voice like actors in the movie. Mm-hmm. You weren't like, oh, that's famous 80s star Goldie Hawn,
right,
The Little Mermaid or whatever. And then sort of with Aladdin, with Robin Williams, it started to become a bigger part of it. And now it's to the point where, like, almost every voice, like in Tangled, for instance, like, pretty much every single voice in that movie is voiced by, like, an actor you could recognize if you're, like, even slightly well-versed in, like, sitcoms.
Or pop music.
That, yeah. Well, that it feels more like it's a completely different world, but they both feel organic in their own ways. But like, it's really weird when like I don't recognize most of the voices, and then Demi Moore and Kevin Kline just pop up in the movie, and I'm like, oh, so that's Demi Moore playing. Also, a weird element of it is like there's a racial problem with all of the Hunchback of Notre Dame movies of whitewashing, casting white people to play the Romani characters. And like in the first one, like for some reason, because it's like I'm just looking at a white woman, like it doesn't like distract me as much, but I'm looking at a picture of a Romani woman, but voiced by Demi Moore, who I explicitly know what she looks like. And this like a weird like tension, an unpleasant tension created in that. And it also exists in the space between CGI and hand-drawn, and there's some issues there. And then they even go further where I feel like with the characters themselves, like they don't have a super consistent style. Like they draw the bad guy whose name I can't remember, like the Justice of the Peace. Yeah. Like he is drawn in like a more traditional, like sort of Disney's B catalog way, like a black cauldron, like kind of scary, imposing, but still based in realism character, you know. But then like the gargoyles are very cartoony in their look, and then Esmeralda is our classic, you know, totem for the lascivious dads out there. Like she's drawn very sexually, which is like, on the one hand, the characterization is good because she's like very in control of her personhood and her sexuality, and she's like, this is who I am. But on the other hand, it's a kids' movie, and like, who are these like cleavage shots for? Right. So it's just like, it's a movie that is very strongly being pulled in a lot of different directions. But I will say, if you don't watch the whole movie, but the Hellfire sequence is actually one of the best Disney moments. It's not just a great song, but the way it's animated is genuinely unique for their catalog in terms of exploring themes in the character.
Nice. Yeah. I just keep thinking about that clip that she uses over and over again.
I'm listening to a bird!
That's so stupid.
It's probably one of the funnier lines any of the gargoyles get.
I can't believe it. I'm listening to a bird! Is he playing cards with a pigeon? What is going on in this movie? Jesus.
Patrick, how about you?
All right. I'm going to denounce a movie by someone who I admittedly enjoy as a filmmaker, and that's Buster Keaton. But I'm going to denounce The General. I don't think it's anywhere near his best work. It's a little bit too much sort of like Confederate apologia, like even pre Gone with the Wind, like Confederate apologia. It's like the Confederates were good guys too, and it's like not at all comfortable with that. And of course it doesn't even like it doesn't even broach the, you know, the racial component to the conflict in the Civil War, but
it's about states' rights, then, man.
Like, yeah. Apparently.
I mean, I think it's a classic and a long line of films whose theme is, can't we all just get along? Like, there are fine people on each side. Yeah, it's like, no, stop.
A little bit like that. It's that real, like, neoliberal thing of, like, wouldn't it just be nice if we were all polite to each other? Yeah. Can't we just have a polite discourse? It's like, no. Get the fuck out of here. Not even a little bit. And it would at least be more watchable if, like, I thought some of the gags he did here were funny, but like I actually don't find much of anything he does in this movie to be very funny. Like I don't know, like, why people consider this to be sort of the height of Keaton, because a lot of people really like this movie, and I think it's on the AFI list for, you know, one of the best American movies of all time. And I'm like, why? Like, why this one? You know, I know he, like, really ran a train into a river, but, like, who cares? Like, it's in service of a dumb story about a guy, like, you know, just jumping off of a train and back on it to it again. And, you know, the gags aren't that great. Like, he's done better gags than almost all of his other movies. I don't really understand. Like, his persona doesn't really fit well with the story at all either. There's even, like, some, like, weird gags that he does toward the end that, like, they feel like they would fit in a classic Keaton structure, but the content of them is weird. Like, there's a part where he's trying to get somebody to, like, light a cannon or something like that, and he keeps doing his arm down like that, but when it happens, like, somebody in the bushes will pop up and shoot the guy that's supposed to light the cannon, and so he'll turn around and look, and the other guy's dead, so he gets somebody else to do it, and then he drops his hand, and he hears the shot again, but, like, the cannon hasn't gone off because another guy's gotten shot, and I'm like, people are being murdered, but he's playing this for a goofy gag, and I'm like, that's not funny. It's weird. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's upsetting. So, yeah. And all of that in service of, like, oh, now he's a Confederate general at the end. Hooray. Mm.
Happy ending.
No.
Careful. I feel like ever since I started, like, in our, like, group, or let's say a very extended group of people that I, like, I've seen write about movies, the estimations of Keaton and Chaplin respectively have gone in absolute polar directions. Basically, everyone
flip-flop,
beginning to hate Chaplin. This was like 10, 15 years ago, whatever, when I was like started being on LiveJournal, and then, like, now it's gone into the exact opposite, where, like, people are much more skeptical of Keaton in terms of, like, his politics and, like, other things, and, like, his kind of muggy style of acting.
Apolitical. Yeah. It's just issue. And so,
yeah,
when we were younger, we watched it, we were like, fair, bring enough us the gags, we don't want this, we don't want this commentary. Yeah. This is boring. Why is he marching with communists? Who cares?
Yeah, boring. Chaplin, like, with his boring messages about, like, social justice,
not non-stop jokes. And, you know, Keaton was a better person, so, like, we like to look at the artist and be like, ah, it filters down into his art. His art must be good. He was a good person. He didn't marry a 14-year-old.
Yeah. he wasn't proto Woody Allen.
It wasn't complicit in covering up a murder on a boat.
a lot of icky, dark, terrible things.
I think the answer to your question as to why it's considered so great was in your criticism of it. It's Confederate apologia with a can't we all get along. It's basically setting up the modern American viewpoint. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we're such a divided nation.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a problem. I think, like, no health care is, like, the actual problem. Mm-hmm. Environmental collapse is, like, a problem. I don't really care if people agree with me.
Yeah, poverty.
Yeah, pretending, you know, immigrants and trans people aren't people, that's a problem. And if that's the viewpoint you're going to take, then, yeah, we're going to be divided.
Mm.
There's nothing that's going to bring us together.
Divide me up, baby.
Basil.
Or my enemy.
What's your next take?
I will destroy you.
I am going to denounce Waiting for Guffman.
Right. Basil in a very denouncing mood.
Just shut it down.
I had rewatched Spinal Tap a couple years ago and didn't find it as funny as I did initially, but there were still some gags that made me laugh. But basically, the entirety of Waiting for Guffman, I don't think I laughed at all. I think Christopher Guest's, like, characterization of Guffman is, like, vaguely homophobic, and, you know, I mean, classic 90s playing gayness for laughs or whatever, but yeah, that hasn't aged particularly well. But even outside of that, like, the choice of target feels pretty dumb and shitty. It's like, ha, look at these losers in the middle of America thinking they could, like, do a good play. What a bunch of idiots. And I'm just like, they're just having fun. Like, leave them alone. Like, they're just trying to, you know, they're a bunch of amateurs doing kind of an amateur thing, and they're just trying to have a good time and, you know, be creative. Like, you know, I don't know. Just, like, who are the people that hate, like, small town theater so much, but, like, supposedly, like, have to watch it? Like, it's, like, not even a thing with, like, a big audience. You're not, like, critiquing some, like, larger cultural movement of being, like, this blockbuster sucks or whatever. At least, like, in those instances, it's, like, you know, it's media that's widely disseminated. This is just, like, a private performance for, like, people's family and friends in a small town. It's, like, boy, these oafs, they really suck at acting.
Yeah. It's a cool equivalent of, like, going, finding, like, a kid from drama class and beating him up for being in drama class or whatever. Like, yeah. Fucking loser.
Yes. It's kind of rude. Now that I think about it, a lot of those comedies by the same group of people are kind of like that. They're just, like, making fun of these very sort of, like, insular communities. It's like people going to dog shows. What a bunch of idiots. Or, you know, folks.
How dare they care about something so minor? Yeah. It's like you commenting about it is actually caring about something even
minor. More minor, yeah.
More minor.
Oh, Lord.
Even minorer.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty silly. Too bad. They couldn't have young Christopher Guest being very handsome in it.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, he really plays up the stylization to make him look as ridiculous as possible, which is costume jokes. Always very good if they're loud and in your face, being like, ha! Ah, look how ugly his clothes are. But he thinks he looks really good.
I rewatched Party Down recently, and they have an episode about local theater.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
It's pretty funny, like, because, like, Roman is, like, being very smug and jerky about it, and then as soon as they're, like, nice to him,
gets into
because
it.
They find out he's a writer, he's, like, way in love with them, and, like, it's, like, a nice thing. Like, they're just, like, yeah, it's like you said, they're just having fun. And he's, like, resentful of the fact that they can have fun on a smaller scale than he can. That he has, like, these grandiose visions of, like, what good is. And they're like, this is good enough. And, like, that is what infuriates him. But when they say, you are also good enough, he's like, I love it.
Oh, the writer. Yeah, I remember that episode.
Yeah, should rewatch Party Down. I remember that. I remember liking that episode. Weird farcical episode. So is Basil, if Basil is in a denouncy mood, then I'm in a heraldy mood today. So my third herald is for High Flying Bird, the Steven Soderbergh NBA classic. which is yeah, it's an interesting, like, it's weird to me that Steven Soderbergh, of all people, is the guy that directed this movie. I think it probably had, I don't know what exactly led to it, because it's a movie made mostly, it's written by the guy that wrote Moonlight, a black playwright. It's it features almost exclusively black actors and actresses, except for Kyle MacLachlan in a really funny Donald Sterling-esque appearance. The acting is pretty great across the board. It's really fun. Like, everyone gets to shine a little bit. I kind of liked especially, what's her name? Zazie Beetz. She was really cool. Kima from The Wire shows up in it, Son Yeon-soon, who has a really specific style of acting that always a little bit takes you a little bit of time to like remember that this is not like Kima from The Wire. But it's also really funny. She gets a lot of good lines. Bill Duke gets a lot of good, fun lines. The cast is really stacked. It's a lot of good actors in this movie. And it's a fun kind of joke about the fact that, I mean, to me, this is quite true. I'm not, obviously, it's different for US viewers, but my relationship with the NBA is mostly based around listening to what happened, like reading about stuff that happened on Reddit or whatever, on NBA Reddit, watching like clips or highlight videos, and generally kind of the sport mostly existing like in my head, like, oh, I bet like this team is like moving in that direction because of this or whatever, like rumors and behind the scenes type stuff inform the narrative of that sport a lot, and maybe in effect even more than the actual games, where the NBA has actually seen a large decline in terms of actual viewership of the age of the people that it mostly values for advertising and stuff. It's also like a really weird league that, you know, mostly makes its money through like exorbitant TV contracts and like arena sales, and is, you know, run by billionaires who call themselves owners and stuff like that. There's a lot of weird shit about this, about the league, and at the same time, it's also like a really, oh, we're like a really progressive league. We try to like let our players say what they want about politics and stuff, and like there's a lot of stuff like kind of hypocritical and contradictory about the league. It's also, you know, one of the best like entertainment products in the world to me. So I think this movie gets at a lot of those points. It also has like a good way of entry, reminding everybody that like, well, if there is a way to disrupt this system, it would come from a black entrepreneur. It would come in the form of trying to own the product themselves, the product being the game, and also the way that people enjoy the game and in the let's say framework in which they enjoy it, which shouldn't be dictated by major networks and like billionaires, because it's, you know, performed by people that are the exact opposite of that most of the time. I think there's a lot of scenes in this movie that get at that point pretty well. I think sometimes it's maybe a little bit too cute in that it combines that with the whole Netflix thing, where there's like literal scenes of the guy going up to Netflix and saying, hey, I'm gonna scare the networks by like trying to like get my games on Netflix. Like, we get it. Yeah, Netflix.
Right.
Yeah, cool.
Disrupting.
The great equalizer. The great progressive network. So that part was a little bit, you know, iffy on, but otherwise it's fun. The iPhone thing doesn't bother you that much, and I probably has my favorite collection of actors that I've seen in a while. So yeah, thumbs up.
What you said reminded me of when I watched Hoop Dreams, which you know, the title is not about how it's really cool to grow up impoverished, dreaming about becoming famous as a basketball player. It's about the kind of fallacy of that. And at the time that I watched it, I was super into the NBA, and I was just like, this movie's not fun enough. I wanted more fun basketball stuff.
Yeah. Shout out to our friend of the podcast, Mitchell, too, for his review. I ended up reading it after I'd written mine and seeing that, like, he had a lot of thoughts that I had about this movie as well. He wrote a nice little piece about it. It's really good.
Good times.
Whoop, whoop. Mitchell!
Yeah. Alright, who's up next?
Ruben!
Back to you.
Okay, for my final movie, I'm going to herald a rewatch, and that's Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Which biggest problem is the fact that it's a Shakespeare? Like, Neither Leo nor Claire Danes do a particularly good job handling Shakespearean dialogue, and part of that is not so much because of them. The actors who are better at handling Shakespearean dialogue seem out of place sometimes in the aesthetic of the film, which is like this heat stroke stained MTV teenage collage of like just raw emotion. It's Twilight without the commentary. Like, it's just, you know, or I mean, I guess you could say it's Romeo and Juliet without the commentary, because I think Romeo and Juliet is traditionally misinterpreted in this way of being about like really pure passionate love and not about how pure passionate love is actually very violent and unyielding and causes a lot of destruction, and that the love that Romeo and Juliet share is, you know, like the currently nice, pure mirror version of the hatred that the Montagues and Capulets have, that that's the same emotion, just expressed in two different ways.
Right.
But it's also of the ones that I've seen, which I think is most Baz Luhrmann films at this point, like the purest distillation of his like over the top intense style in a way that really suits both like the thematic and like narrative arcs. Like, it's not a huge part of it, but definitely one of my problems with Moulin Rouge is that they're adults, and I'm like, why are they acting like this? Like, I just, it's, I don't know, like a Dalian is, Ewan McGregor goes, "This is your song," or whatever. Like, it doesn't work for me because, like, he's like 30.
Yeah.
Whereas Leo's like a baby in this. And it's so beautifully rendered. There's some iconic moments that got eaten up in like pretty much every music video post it existing, but they're so awesome, of like them looking at each other through the aquarium, or like falling in, or like crawling through the sheets together. And I'm like, was Luhrmann the first one to do all this stuff, or was it like, or did he just perfect it in such a way that it just feels unbelievably iconic watching it now? So,
love me, love me.
Cool.
Yeah. Another problem is he tried to do some commentary with what is it Romeo, is he the Montagues, is it Romeo Montague and Juliet Capulet? That's right. Yeah, so the Montagues are white and the Capulets are supposed to be Latin in this movie, but Claire Danes is 100% Claire Danes, and then the other Capulets other than John Leguizamo are all white people who talk with like mildly affected accents.
Oh god.
Yeah.
No thank you.
I guess that's
90s.
Also not a far cry from West Side Story, Natalie Wood, right, about a person of color.
True. Yeah. That's true. The other actors were there. But here's the reverse. Instead of one white character surrounded by real Latin people, it's one one Latin person, John Leguizamo, surrounded by all white people.
Yeah, all white people, and one guy that plays Mercutio.
Yeah, but I'm saying his family.
Yeah, his whole family. Yeah.
The guy who plays Mercutio is really good in it as well.
Yeah. What is that actor's name?
The guy from Oz.
The guy from Oz.
The guy from Lost. American History X. The guy from Lost. That's his name.
I remember his name.
A lot of iconic performances.
All right. Well, I am kind of torn on what I'm going to herald here, so I think I'm going to go with something that no one has heralded yet. I'm going to herald the movie Greta, Neil Jordan movie with Isabelle Huppert and Chloe Grace Moretz. It's in theaters now, if you want to go see it. It's kind of a, you know, by the numbers little thriller. You kind of know where it's going. If you've ever seen, you know, any of these, like, abduction movies, Misery, or, I'm trying to think of another one right now. But, like, in that vein, in that sort of, like, I know there's another Stephen King movie that's similar to that. Probably, like, not The Shining, necessarily, but, like, that same thing where someone's trapped with a psychotic person and, you know. But this movie actually does a good job with kind of all the bells and whistles of really setting the mood. Especially in the way that it's cut. Jordan will, like, hold on shots of actors' faces while somebody is saying something to them off screen and kind of lets them have, like, a full reaction to what's being said. And it really, like, digs in a little more when it does that. And I kind of like that because it kind of, you feel that tension of, like, not being able to see how the other person looks when they say this thing, and you just see the other person's reaction to it. And I liked those moments because I was like, ooh, he held that beat just long enough for that emotional, you know, punch to land to me, and then, like, you know, got on with the story. But it's actually, you know, a really economic movie, too. It doesn't waste a lot of time. And the performances are good. I like that Isabelle Huppert is having a lot of fun playing this crazy lady, and doing a good job, doing a lot of, like, interesting things that I don't usually see people in these kinds of roles do. Like, she actually seems to be enjoying herself, both textually and metatextually, in the performance in certain cases. There's parts where she, like, dances around someone that she's just drugged, and it's weird and upsetting, but also, like, you know, it's a very interesting performance, and, you know, something that Ruben pointed out that she does in the movie where she, like, kind of switches between lying and telling the truth, but you can kind of see the seams of, like, where her actual sort of pain, her inner pain, comes from. And you can actually tell that, like, at a certain point she's actually telling you the truth about how she feels about this thing and, like, why it affected her so badly and why she is the way she is now. And that's kind of interesting for a villain, not to, like, outright, like, try and do a Thanos thing where they're like, you feel sorry for them, but, like, you're kind of like, oh yeah, this, you can see the pain, like, you can see where it's shining through in this person. And, you know, you still don't like her, but you're like, oh no, you feel bad for her at the same time. But also, Micah Monroe's in this movie, and she's probably the best person ever to be with if you're in a horror movie, because she, you know, she survived the guest.
She's a survivor, gonna make it. Survivor, keep on surviving.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's very fun in this movie, though. She gets to play the kind of, like, the best friend character who's not necessarily, like, more worldly-wise, but she's, like, more aggressive. Like, she's the aggressive friend who's, like, always trying to get Chloe Grace Moretz to go out and do stuff. She's like, come to this party, we're gonna do this thing, it's gonna be great. And she's, like, being followed by a killer, and she's like, I'm fine, I'm gonna, like, go after her. She tries to walk across the street and fight Isabelle Huppert at one point. It's just like, you know, she's very, because it's kind of against the type that you usually see her playing, where she's this kind of, like, scared, you know, like, I don't know, like Hitchcockian blonde in a lot of movies, where she's just, like, kind of the scared, you know, what does he say, the footprints in the snow or whatever, I can't remember the metaphor he uses, but it's like, it's something like bloody footprints in the snow or something like that. But no, she's very fun in this movie, and yeah, I enjoy all the lead performances in it too. Good stuff.
One of the weirder aspects of this movie is that relationship is fairly cliche. Like, or cliche is not exactly the right word, because cliche is normally used badly. It's just something you've seen a lot before, of, like, two friends living in New York, and one of them, like, is supposed, like, has, like, a cynical view of the world, and one of them is supposed to be from, like, more small town, and, like, you know, is, like, a trusting, generous person. But then they reveal that she's from Boston, and I'm like, that's not a small town. Why? She's like, that's not how people act where I'm from. And I'm like, from Boston?
Yeah, and then you kind of
notoriously
find
nice town.
Yeah, she's really more just naive than anything else, because you see her dad's like this just really rich guy who's like giving these presentations at like a corporation. Yeah, and it's like she's just a really naive rich person.
I think that it's they're both pretty rich. They're wafted in New York as a graduation present from Mike Monroe's father.
Yeah.
So that's like a $2 million graduation present, at least, depending on where the loft is. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that Boston thing could like almost be like a funny commentary both on like that aspect of movies and also like the idea that the thing, something that like a lot of people will think is that cities that are more majority white, they'll think of as being like nicer, regardless of the actual quality of the city or how it became white. But I don't think that's intentional. It's just something that I laughed at in the movie.
Cool. Interested in that one now. Mm-hmm. Basil, how about you?
All right. My last one, I'll end on a positive.
Yay!
Harold, Final Destination 2.
All right.
Bringing it back. Nice, tidy job I did there, tying it all together. But, it's, really leans into the macabre humor aspect of it. Like, even though it's just as, if not more gory than the first one, somehow the way they play it lands a lot better. David Ellis, it's like pretty mean-spirited, but in a way that's pretty fun. Like, I was just like, this is a grisly movie, but it's making me laugh. And I guess it works. Part of it is toning down the kind of cornier filmmaking style. It's more straightforward, but really goes over the top with the Rube Goldberg stuff in it. It lays it on pretty thick, especially when a kid is at the dentist office. There's like a million things going wrong with the dentist, including apparently that this new dentist office, like, pigeons just keep flying into the window, and the dentist is like, I wish these, what's going on with these pigeons? It's just like this loud banging into the, while he's like trying to do dental work in the doomed child's mouth or whatever. It's this boom, boom. And, but yeah, it's very funny. The initial setup of like, a giant, like, multi-car pileup that kills everybody is edited super well. It's like, and you know, as far as I could tell, it's basically all practical except for maybe like a little bit of CGI fire or something like that when someone dies, but otherwise it's just like they really wrecked a bunch of cars. They really, you know, drove a truck down the highway and had a bunch of like logs fall off of it, like Michael Bay would do later in The Island, I think, with the metal pipes or whatever.
Yeah,
and I was
right.
Like,
forget about that.
But yeah, it's I was very into it for a while. I was almost gonna give it 4 stars, but then the ending wraps up a little too fast. Like, I was excited for more and ridiculous Rube Goldberg things, but then one of the last ones offs like multiple of the people all in a row, and I was like, no, I wanted one for each person. These are too fun to just.
Yeah, I think you would have a 4-star film if you were to take the cast of 3 and make them the cast of 2, because the cast of 3 is by far the best total cast.
For sure.
And I think David Ellis is the best director, but like, there's definitely also some acting problems with 2, just like with 1.
Good old David.
Yeah, there's some,
David Ellis
very silly.
On a plane too.
He sure did.
And Cellular, another fun movie that I rewatched a couple years ago and held up for me.
Nice. Cool.
Surprised about.
Happy to hear that. Yeah.
But yeah, that, I mean, I don't know where else you could go with that film other than that tone. It's very strange that we're, as an audience, attracted to this idea. It's like, we're really scared of death. We want to watch the most unlikely and complex ways in which we could die. Why?
Yeah. But it's great. I can't explain it either. I have no idea why it's so compelling, but boy howdy.
It's like, sure, I really want to discover new anxieties that didn't exist before.
Yeah.
People getting really obsessed with determinism.
Yeah.
The fun thing about that, I don't know, like, it's just so, I don't know. Yeah, there's something just so very weird about the idea of just like a person dying in a really strange way. Like, I remember there was a website, I don't know if it's still up, but it's basically just like somebody making compilations of like ways people get killed in horror movies. And I actually find that way more interesting to watch than the movies themselves. I just want to see like how the character dies. And then like, if I'm at all interested, I'll go back and look for some context for like why that happened to that person in that way. But like, the death itself is so much more interesting to me than the character or the movie that they're in.
Well, that's where like all the thought is put into most of the time. Like, less the characters themselves.
It's like, how are we going to get this character to the point where we can kill them in this weird way?
In the 90s, horror movies and action movies crossed over, where the horror movies started with the action set pieces and then built to film off of that, and so they have great action now, and action movies started treating the action set pieces as a secondary, unimportant part of the genre, and now action movies have terrible action sequences.
Yes. Very true.
Good times.
All right. Anyone else has any heralds or announcements?
We've all done four, unless you want to do a last one.
No, I'm good.
All right.
I'm good.
Taking it home.
All right. So thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you listen in next time, which will be... we'll see when, but we'll keep doing this as a regular installment. So watch out for more of the same. Thanks a lot for listening. Please like and subscribe it in your favorite podcast app, and check out our website. That'll probably maybe even be up at this point by the time that this is released. So yeah, hope you're enjoying it. Give us some feedback. What are you thinking? What you're not thinking? Just all of your thoughts, really. And thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.